Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. The military's drone program has been an integral part of the so-called war on terror. According to the Bureau of Investigative Journalism, in Pakistan, Yemen, and Somalia, from 2002 to 2014, between 2,600 and 4,100 people have been killed by the CIA's drone program. Now, when we talk about drones, we tend to focus on drones that kill or hurt people. But what doesn't get much attention is the proliferation of commercial drones here in the United States. These are drones that are able to shoot aerial photos and videos and collect other data. And they're used in many sectors, including movie making, sports, mining, oil and gas production, and construction. The FAA estimates that as many as 7,500 small commercial drones will be in use within about 5 years. Once the necessary regulations are in place. And a report by the Association for Unmanned Vehicle Systems International says that the commercial drone industry will create more than 100,000 high-paying jobs and will inject $82 billion into the U.S. economy between 2015 and 2025. So who's using these domestic drones? What are the implications for personal privacy and the regulation of the U.S. airspace? What are the pros and cons of small commercial drones? Who's collecting our data? How will this be used? This is all brand new territory. And joining us to talk about this is George Schultz, an award-winning Homeland Security reporter for the Center for Investigative Reporting. And he joins us from Austin, Texas. Hi, George. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Nice to have you. Parker Higgins is an activist with the Electronic Frontier Foundation, a civil liberties nonprofit dedicated to ensuring our rights and freedoms make it into the digital world intact. And Parker joins us from his office in San Francisco. Hi, Parker.
Hi.
And Sean Musgrave is projects editor of Muckrock, a collaborative news site that brings together journalists, researchers, activists, and citizens to analyze and share government documents, making politics more transparent and democracies more informed. And he joins us from Boston. Hi, Sean. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for having me.
Nice to have you. So, Parker, why don't we start off with you? Domestic drones in U.S. skies don't really get much attention. Can you just describe what kinds of drones are we really talking about here?
So generally, the kinds of drones we're talking about are much smaller than the ones that we hear about in the military. Although the military is using small drones as well, and in domestic skies, we've got government agencies that are flying the same, roughly the same kinds of drones. So there is a lot of overlap. Of course, the ones here aren't weaponized. But these have some of the same really powerful surveillance capabilities. And we have, for example, the Border Patrol in the U.S. operates a fleet of what are called Predator drones, roughly the same kind that fly in Afghanistan and in Pakistan, and those are in use today in the U.S.
George, what would you add to that? What else do we need to know about domestic drones and how they differ from the drones that are used overseas?
Yeah, they're definitely going to be a lot smaller, the ones used here. I mean, one of the things that's going to be a learning for police and public safety officials about them is going to be the fact that they're smaller and cheaper than the types of aircraft and fleets that police have historically had. And because they're going to be so much cheaper, I think that's why police are increasingly going to want to deploy them for public safety purposes. And I think the political atmosphere right now isn't where police would like it to be at. But eventually, I think a lot of police departments are assuming it will improve the way it did around street-level surveillance cameras, and they'll be able to ease some of those costs that they generally have to absorb for even one helicopter, let alone two, three, or four. You have to pay for pilots, you have to pay for mechanics, you have to pay for maintenance of the individual aircraft, which for helicopters can be really, really steep. If you can get great visuals out of a small drone, I think it's going to be really attractive for police. But there'll be an ongoing debate, a continued debate about what's legal for police to do with drones and what isn't.
Hmm. Well, and there's also just legalities about small drones in general, because, I mean, we've got some numbers that say we'll have about 7,500 small drones in U.S. skies within about 5 years, and then other numbers say we're going to have 30,000 by the end of the decade. So when we look at commercial drones, Sean, do you expect this industry to really explode? Could we possibly have 30,000 drones in the sky by the end of the decade?
I'm not sure about the exact numbers of the projections. I know, as you said, the projections vary pretty widely, but there is quite a bit of enthusiasm among a number of different sectors, as you mentioned in your introduction, for this technology, both in the private sector and the public sector. Most of my work is focused on how government agencies are eager to use unmanned aerial vehicles in a variety of different capacities, whether law enforcement or using them as sort of remote sensing in a much smaller system than what's currently used. But I do think that the enthusiasm is definitely there. And as George had said, the costs are dropping very quickly, both for the sensors that are on board as well as for the platforms themselves. So the enthusiasm is there, the demand is there, and the producers themselves are certainly pushing to be able to expand their market. Mm-hmm.
Well, we'll talk a little bit about how they'll be used for law enforcement, because the Association for Unmanned Vehicle Systems International, this is a trade group that represents producers and users of drones and other robotic equipment, and they predict that about 80% of the commercial market for drones will actually be used for agricultural uses. Mm-hmm. So it'll allow farmers to monitor their crops. And so we'll talk about that today, but there's still a small percentage used for law enforcement, but still really important. So how are law enforcement departments across the country using drones now, and what will happen in the future? Sean?
Go ahead, Parker.
I think that the point you made about agriculture is really interesting. The way it's been described is that these are going to be used for jobs that are considered too dull, dirty, or dangerous for human pilots to be doing. But I think when it comes to law enforcement, something that that George said before really resonates is that these are so much cheaper than the cost of manned aircraft. And so we haven't seen it deployed that widely yet, but in a lot of cases, police departments are saying in advance that the ways that they can use these are much greater than they would be able to use a helicopter or a manned plane, because they can afford to put it up more often and they can afford to have someone flying it. And so that's really a thing where before, the limits on what the police can be doing were practical limits, and maybe now they need to be legal limits.
And some of these drones could weigh less than 55 pounds. How much money are we talking?
So the drones that police departments are looking at, for one thing, a really important thing about the money, and Sean can talk about this more, is that this money is often being given in the form of grants from the Department of Homeland Security to local and state police and law enforcement agencies. And then purchasing the drones is usually somewhere on the order of $10,000 to $50,000 for one of these law enforcement units. But then really the hourly cost, when you don't have to employ a licensed pilot, you don't have to pay for like helicopter fuel, is an order of magnitude lower than what it would be for a helicopter or for a manned plane.
And we're looking at, I mean, the drone industry is expected to just explode between $82 billion between 2015 and 2025, again, according to this Association for Unmanned Vehicle Systems International. Parker, do you know, in terms of the companies that make the drones, are we talking about the same companies that make the drones overseas?
In some cases, there are some organizations that are making that have really come into prominence as military contractors that are also marketing to police, and I think that to police and commercially. And I think that there's a really widely held sense in the industry that the next frontier of selling these drones to either to end users or to government agencies is really going to be domestically. So the ones that that haven't been geared towards that traditionally are scrambling to get something on the market.
And George, I know that you were involved in a report that looked at local police departments using drones. And in one case, in June, a drone helped local police in North Dakota with surveillance, leading to what may be the first domestic arrests with the help of a drone. What has happened since then?
That's still been one of the most high-profile stories so far. There's been some additional reporting. I think the AP did it on the Department of Homeland Security loaning out their Predator drones more frequently than was previously realized. But we'd already known that DHS was actually promoting that dimension of its drone program. Its fleet and the full program has costed a lot of money, somewhere around $250 million. So they needed, if they weren't going to be used strictly for border observations, they needed to have other things they could say that the drones were being useful for. And one of those could be loaning them to local public safety agencies. And it's worth keeping in mind, too, that, you know, this technology is attractive also to, like, statewide firefighters, places like California where they have a lot of problems, wildfires in Arizona. I'm sure there's going to be a strong attraction to using the technology more. And some places like Texas, state police have ditched their drone programs for the time being because the FAA rules were considered too headache-inducing. But as that changes down the road with pressure from Congress and the industry, I think you'll see agencies moving back to using unmanned aircraft. But one thing we pointed out in the meantime that police are doing that gets little attention, what we've pointed out in our reporting is that often what's more important is the surveillance payload on the aircraft and not necessarily whether or not there's a pilot inside of it. The drones have been a sexy story for a few years now, but often what I've been interested in is how powerful the surveillance device on the belly of the aircraft is, right? So if an aircraft with a pilot in it is doing what's called wide area surveillance and is able to video over a six-hour period, let's say a 25-square-mile area, then you're entering into a privacy and civil liberties debate that's so far beyond street-level cameras that, I mean, we would have to totally rethink the capabilities police had. And wide area surveillance has already been used in Iraq and Afghanistan to attempt to monitor insurgents and individuals planting IEDs. So there's already buzz in the law enforcement community and in the military community about adapting those technologies in the United States. I think reporting-wise, for me, I care sometimes less about whether or not there's a pilot in the aircraft than how powerful the surveillance payload is.
So what about the legalities behind all of this?
And, you know, the individuals promoting that type of surveillance technology argue that as of now, you have no reasonable expectation of privacy when it comes to law enforcement using that type of technology. I think what's stopping a lot of departments from, let's say, contracting with a company that has developed a domestic stateside version of wide area surveillance is they're concerned that people would freak out over it. I think they're going to be pushing, pilot or not, down the road for the monetary value of drones and the surveillance payload attached to them and the public safety value. I think you're going to see police arguing that they had the capability to make, let's say, a tactical raid or SWAT raid much safer for the officers involved. You're going to see departments, I believe, arguing that they could deconstruct crimes by zooming in into certain areas and tagging cars and individuals and maybe associated with, say, a shooting or a robbery. And they're going to argue that they're able to generate leads and evidence in ways that they couldn't before. And I think a lot of departments are going to believe that that's a strong case to make. But I think, especially when it comes to things like wide area surveillance, being able to cover so much ground, blanket an area with video surveillance, I think it's going to be startling to a lot of folks when they realize, you know, it's not just a Sony home video camera that you know film your family with.
Right. Well, and so that's the other question is how can the public keep up with this? Because domestic drones, are they get some attention in the media if you really look for it, but not that much. And also the other interesting thing about this is domestic drones could also be used for some amazing things. And we'll talk about this later. But about a month or so ago, there was some amazing footage of whales in California. There's this outfit in Dana Point, California, and they got whales swimming. And one of the captains said, Captain Dave, he said, this is the most beautiful and compelling video I've ever seen of animals. Drones are going to change how we view the animal world. So there's also some really amazing things that can happen here. So, Sean, how do you think we should deal with this? Because it seems like it's happening so quickly.
Yes, and the technology is advancing very quickly. And I think George kind of touched on the public freaking out about the idea of drones. And I do think that there are a number of very legitimate applications of this technology. And I think there are very few people who are arguing that we should go back to a pre-drone time, because there are, as Parker also said, the dull, dirty, and dangerous jobs, if we can move those, everything from radiation monitoring to all manner of different things that you could use an unmanned sensor for, in a lot of cases that would be incredibly advantageous to take a person out of that position. But on the flip side of that, if the government wants to alleviate a lot of that freaking out that George talked about, we absolutely need more transparency around how this equipment is being used. My project with Muckrock, the drone census, which is in partnership with the Electronic Frontier Foundation, has been working very, very hard and has had to work very hard to get information out of the various government agencies that are using drones. They're protecting their protocols, they're protecting their privacy impact assessments to a degree that's really absurd and only feeds the perception that this is mysterious or technology that people should be afraid of. And I think if it's going to be integrated more into the social fabric, then it needs to be subject to public scrutiny. Hmm. That's what our project is trying to do.
That is Sean Musgrave. He's project's editor of Muckrock. It's a collaborative news site that brings together journalists, activists, researchers, and they analyze and share government documents, making politics more transparent and democracies more informed. Parker Higgins is an activist with the Electronic Frontier Foundation, a civil liberties nonprofit dedicated to ensuring citizens' rights and freedoms. And George Schultz is an award-winning Homeland Security reporter for the Center for Investigative Reporting. And today we are talking about domestic drones, which is now just starting to get a lot more attention. By the year 2018, the FAA says 7,500 small drones will be in operation in U.S. skies. And how do you strike a balance? Because, again, they'll be used from everything from filming animals and changing the way we see animals to helping conservationists keep an eye on endangered species by looking for poachers in places like the Himalayan foothills, where it's like a 360 square mile swath of wetland, really difficult to track on foot, but much easier to deal with a drone. But then you've got Border Patrol using drones, you've got police forces using drones. So how do you strike a balance here, and what concerns do you have about regulation, about privacy, about not knowing how these drones are used? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. And because this is fairly new, what questions do you have about commercial small drones? 866-798-8255. And if you work in one of these fields, like agriculture, they're saying that 80% of small drones will be used in agriculture. What are your thoughts about how they might be used in some of these different industries? You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. So, George, what about that question? How do you strike a balance between what drones can be used for in terms of, you know, animals or following poachers and places like the Himalayan foothills to instances that make people a little uncomfortable?
A lot of the types of uses you described, I think the public's not necessarily going to have a difficult time with. I didn't see a lot of people objecting to the use of drones to gather some of the most compelling footage we saw of the protests in the Ukraine, right? Mm. But one aspect of the debate that sometimes goes overlooked in the United States is that Congress and the FAA, and ultimately the White House to some extent, will have to debate the civil liberties and privacy elements associated with unmanned aircraft. But the FAA, what it's really going to have to think a lot about in the next several years is rewriting the nation's regulatory framework around aircraft to accommodate drones, because it's not just about whether or not someone should have the right to use an unmanned aircraft for commercial purposes. It's like the civil rules we all have to follow on the road, right? I have to stop at a stop sign so you can go through the intersection, and we have to both agree to a set of rules that keeps people safe as much as possible on the road. Well, the same thing exists for the U.S. airspace. I mean, the airspace seems very vast, and it seems difficult to imagine anyone colliding with one another. But usually people take certain routes that are most convenient across the United States or avoid certain areas that are a little less safe or are highly regulated by the FAA, so you fly around it. It puts people in more opportunities to accidentally collide with one another. And when you add several thousand unmanned aircraft to that scenario, you're talking about a whole new body of rules that the FAA is going to have to try to establish and enforce. So I think that's one of the big challenges they're facing right now. They're discussing the privacy element, but I think it's really frustrating Congress in terms of the amount of time it's taking for the FAA is getting the regulatory framework set up to ensure safety. And then after that, I think it would be likely that you'd see more commercial uses that don't upset a lot of people or concern a lot of people, like filmmakers using them, firefighters using them to observe an area that's on fire, hobbyists using them, journalists even using them to gather a footage of protests in places like Ukraine. Then you might see the police departments adopting them more under a certain set of rules. And the rules might end up not even coming out of Washington. They might come from counties or state legislatures.
Well, that's the other question I had. Are we going to get a patchwork of laws to regulate drones?
It's possible. That's what we have with a lot of other law enforcement technologies to begin with. And it's something we've talked a lot about in stories at CIR, that often from one state to the next, you can't always be sure what the rules are for things like GPS tracking and for things like using certain types of eavesdropping technologies. I think that's a big ongoing story for public safety in the 21st century, is how digital tools are adapted by police. Some of them are extremely powerful, and if the police were investigating something that happened to someone in my family, it'd be hard for me to object to a tool that was very useful to their investigation.
Well, we've got
we do already, to a certain extent, have that patchwork that you were talking about. A number of cities have enacted legislation that bar their police departments from purchasing or using drones, as well as a large number of states have at least introduced legislation to that would either bar or heavily restrict the use of drones. And a few of them have passed them already.
43 states have proposed this legislation.
In 2013 alone, 43 states introduced 130 bills and resolutions addressing this issue.
Yep.
So it seems like we're definitely going to have a patchwork. We have just a few minutes or 1 minute before break, but quickly, which government agency really tracks this? I mean, does the FAA right now know how many drones are flying in U.S. skies, George?
They're not going to know how many hobbyists are flying drones under a certain height. And they're not going to contact the hobbyyist unless it appears the hobbyist is using the unmanned aircraft for commercial purposes, and then they'll try to fine them. But a judge actually tossed one of those fines recently. On the other side, as far as like the Border Patrol's use of drones, experimental test flights in very remote areas, the FAA definitely has a lot of paperwork on those types of aircraft and keeps track of them.
All right, we're going to take.
But even there, they haven't been.
Go ahead.
Hello.
Go ahead.
Oops, sorry, I lost you for a second. Even though the FAA doesn't have a complete view of this, as you mentioned earlier, a lot of this equipment is incredibly cheap. And so in my work, I've found a number of instances where the FAA had no idea that a particular police department had a drone.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break. Some numbers say that by the end of the decade, we're going to have about 30,000 drones in U.S. skies. And it's your call. We'll be back after this.
Lots of ways to take part in today's conversation on Your Call on the phone by sending an email or by going to the yourcall.org website. If you'd like to join us live, the phone number is toll-free, 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. Or you can send your email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. Coming up in 30 minutes at 11 o'clock from the BBC, World Have Your Say. You're on KALW San Francisco.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll talk about what we can do to save the monarch butterflies. Every year, monarchs migrate thousands of miles from Canada to Mexico, but their numbers are rapidly dwindling because of habitat destruction from logging in Mexico and the elimination of milkweed here in the U.S. April 14th is a day of action for monarchs, so we'll talk about what we need to do to protect them and why this matters. That's tomorrow. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today we are talking about commercial drones. We are talking about the proliferation of these drones. They are expected to explode in the United States in the coming years, and they're used for everything from filming animals to agriculture. A lot of farmers say that this is going to really help them monitor crops and potential diseases, but they're also used at the border and then also used by police departments. So what are your thoughts on the proliferation of drones? What questions do you have about this new and booming sector? According to the Unmanned Vehicle Systems International, the drone industry, commercial drone industry, will create about 100,000 jobs and inject $82 billion into the economy in the United States between 2015 and 2025. So what questions do you have? And if you work in an industry that's thinking about using drones or is using drones, we'd love to hear from you. It sounds weird to even say that. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today we are joined by George Schultz, an award-winning Homeland Security reporter for the Center for Investigative Reporting. Parker Higgins is an activist with the Electronic Frontier Foundation, a civil liberties nonprofit dedicated to ensuring citizens' rights and freedoms. And Sean Musgrave is projects editor of Muckrock, a collaborative news site that brings together researchers, journalists, and activists to analyze and share government data, making politics more transparent. And we have a number of callers on the line, so let's hear from Michael in Salinas. Hi, Michael. Welcome to the show.
Hello. To start off, I'm from Salinas, and I don't know if you know much of that town. We have high crime. We just always have. When I heard of drones, I thought this would be a great thing, but I do understand that it's a double-edged sword, in a sense. My question is, and I was thinking about this a while back, you know, homes have stickers like ADT on them all the time. Mm. How long would it be, you know, time-wise, before we see a box at the end of every block that has ADT printed on it, and then when a home sensor goes off, out the top pops a drone and flies overhead, giving real... And then I know it sounds funny when you think of it, but I honestly think that that would live link itself to an officer via Google Glass, because I think that's where it should probably end up going to.
Huh. Well,
that's like a third arm for law enforcement, is having your drones hooked up to Google Glass.
Wow. Well, and Michael, stay on the line, because I'd love to ask you, since you live in a high-crime area, how you think drones should be used. George, what are your thoughts about that? Do you think that we might see drones act as home security devices one day?
Well, yeah, I think it's entirely possible. And I think what you could see down the road is a whole lot of notification rules, like you have for recordings now in certain states like California. If the call is being recorded, all parties have to be notified. It could be that the legal framework says, okay, as long as you're notifying individuals when they enter an area that they could be videotaped or could be videoed by a drone, then you can use a drone for these types of security purposes. So it sounds feasible to me. Even if it sounds far-fetched now and made us giggle a little bit, I mean, you could see it down the road.
Right. Well, Michael, since you live in a high-crime area, how do you think drones should be used by police?
To be honest, in my city, we have a high gang problem in my city, a high drug problem and gang problem in my city. And it's not uncommon every so often to hear gang members exchanging gunfire at police. To be honest, running into apartment complexes waiting for police officers to come in there. And so I always thought, then when I heard Google Glass and then the idea of drones, you would launch something like that out of the back of a cruiser, it'd fly overhead of an apartment complex over a situation which does happen in our city where someone barricades themselves in a home with a gun, you know, with their family, looking for something overhead that you can't see on the ground. A crime scene, a shooting, that sort of thing, to dispatch a drone to look overhead to notice something that we wouldn't notice on the ground. Like, I understand, too, that it's one of those crazy things where you think about that's impossible, but DNA testing was also viewed the same way a long time ago.
Right. Well, and things are changing so quickly now. Well, you brought up interesting points. Parker, first off, this is unrelated but kind of related. Do you think that cops one day might be wearing something like Google Glasses? And just to let people know who aren't familiar with them, they allow you, they look strange, so it's obvious they're wearing something strange, but they allow you to film without pressing a button. So, I mean, you can film anyone in front of you at any time. Do you think the law enforcement might embrace that one day?
Yeah, we've already seen in some police departments body-mounted cameras on police officers, and in New York they're talking about specifically Google Glass, and that's kind of a mixed bag because in some cases it appears from preliminary evidence that it improves police behavior, that the police themselves feel like they can't engage in brutality or abuse of power because it's being monitored. Mm. So that's interesting. Speaking to the question, I think that we may see an increase in that really tactical use. So they arrive at a scene where there's an armed gunman and they can get more information by an overhead view. I think in general there's a fallacy that's kind of festered for a long time that more surveillance makes cities more safe. And in a lot of places there's no real model for how that works. And you know, drones flying overhead doesn't equal safer citizens if you don't without more information. And so, yeah, there may be something really tactical, and that's actually in the arrest that we heard about earlier on the call. That was how drones were used. They determined where on the property the person that the police were seeking were, and I could see that becoming useful. For now, the drones we're talking about have a really short battery life, and they can't fly very high, and so we're talking about throwing it up for maybe, you know, 15 minutes to get the lay of the land.
Huh. Oh, so the commercial drones are only able to fly for about 15 minutes?
Some of them can fly for longer, but we're not talking about the kinds of endurance that military drones have. And that's to the extent that that's a technical limitation, it's going to be a short-lived one. We've already seen there are drone manufacturers that have put together drones that can be charged from the ground via laser, and in that case, they can stay up for very long periods of time. And there are some that are looking to charge via solar power, and
wow.
So the limitations that exist now, we shouldn't count on those limitations to protect our civil liberties.
Mm. All right. Well, thank you again for calling in, Michael. Let's go next to Robert in Richmond. Hi, Robert. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you very much. Well, my concern as a lawyer and a citizen is what kind of probable cause is going to be necessary to use one of these, and also how are we going to know whether the film or the results of the drones has been tampered with or been messed with? And I guess also that somebody mentioned the lack of expectation for privacy. And I don't think that's really, as far as I know about surveillance, it's not necessarily the main issue. The main issue seems to be whether the police have some extraordinary advantage technologically that wouldn't have been known about or expected. It'll be interesting also to see if the Supreme Court gets this, how they go about talking about the framers' original intent with the Fourth Amendment when it comes to this, you know, drone surveillance. Anyway, the question there really is about what kind of expectation what kind of probable cause do the police need to put one of these in flight?
All right, thank you. We've got a couple emails related to this. Gil writes, what is the current limit on law enforcement's use of aerial surveillance devices like heat sensors? And could Fourth Amendment precedent on it be instructive? George, do you want to take that one?
EFF would be great on this stuff. It's right up their alley. They've been working on this,
okay,
this very issue for a long time.
Parker?
They want to tackle it.
Yeah, so this is a really interesting question. What we've been pushing for and what we've seen in some of the laws that have been introduced is a warrant requirement, that police should have to get a warrant, and in some cases, if they don't get a warrant, then the evidence they collect should be inadmissible. What's really interesting to me is that the precedent that's influencing the police department's interpretation of what they're allowed to do, some of it is from manned aircraft, and the situation with manned aircraft is not very favorable to citizen privacy. It's basically what you can see from the sky is fair game, with some caveats. But then what's been really interesting is that some of the precedent is around what are called dog sniff cases. And so we've seen a number of Supreme Court cases about whether drug-sniffing dogs are allowed to come up to the line of property or whether they're allowed to come to your doorstep. And those have been influential on drone law because dogs are considered, in that case, a technology that's a sensor of something that human beings aren't able to detect. And so It's kind of an interesting place to take law from because it feels a little bit antique in a world where we're talking about drone flight overhead, and so we would really like to see some kind of explicit law or precedent that describes, if not exactly the technology we're seeing, at least the kind of universe of technology we're seeing.
And so what about regulatory laws in effect today? The AP had an interesting story about how a small drone hovered over Washington Nationals players for a few days during spring training in Florida last month, taking publicity photos impossible for a human photographer to capture, but no one got the FAA's permission first. And a team official was contacted by the AP and said, we didn't get it cleared. The official was not authorized to speak publicly. And according to this piece, the FAA bars commercial use of drones, no matter how seemingly benign. So what does the law say right now, Parker?
So it's a little bit in a toss-up right now. The FAA has only really sought to enforce that law in one high-profile case. And very recently, a judge handed down a verdict that basically said the FAA didn't have the authority to enforce it. And that's specifically in the case of small enough drones that they could be considered like hobby model aircraft. But this was the FAA tried to fine a photographer who was using this to photograph aerial views of a city. And they had issued a $10,000 fine, and he has now he's prevailed for now. So that kind of calls into question some of the regulations that the FAA has been using as to whether they have the authority to do that at all. And until that gets settled, I think there's going to continue to be a lot of uncertainty.
Well, and Sean, it seems like, I mean, the industry is really pushing the FAA because they see a lot of money here. I mean, they say that this industry is going to explode, $82 billion between 2015 and 2025.
Certainly, and the drone industry and manufacturers have really heralded that recent decision that Parker was talking about as kind of confirming what they've been contending for a long time, that the FAA took a couple of shortcuts in drafting regulations and didn't have particularly strong footing for putting this ban in place. So I think the FAA is certainly scrambling right now to try to figure out where it lies. It is still issuing its cease and desist orders, or at least reaching out to entities that are using using drones for commercial applications. But this case has thrown a lot of doubt onto what grounds they have to, or what fine finding power they have to back up those cease and desist orders.
And how much of this industry is actually subsidized by the U.S. government? Because there's a company based in Monrovia, California, AeroVironment, and they do a lot of business with the Pentagon, selling them tens of thousands of small drones for troops in Iraq and Afghanistan over the last decade. And they recently unveiled a Cube Quadrator. It's their first small drone specifically targeted at law enforcement and first response applications. So, George, do you know, I mean, how much of this industry right now is subsidized by the U.S. government? Well, and by taxpayers, really.
I mean, I don't know the top-of-the-line figure on how much in contracts that the Pentagon and DHS have done with the drone industry, but it's obviously been a lot in the last several years. It's a much more powerful industry than it used to be. It employs a lot more people in places like Southern California. And the organization representing their interests has definitely been aggressive in Washington and promoting their interests. And, you know, since they contract with the federal government a lot, yeah, I mean, their profits and revenues are generated by taxpayer dollars. But as far as they're concerned, they're a private industry marketing and promoting a technology that has a variety of uses, including in places like Iraq and Afghanistan. So I think that's the way they're going to look at this.
And, Sean, what do you make of the industry saying that this is going to create hundreds of thousands of jobs and pump tens of billions into the economy?
Well, as I said, the estimates vary quite a bit, but the industry is benefiting quite a bit from government subsidy. A number of police departments that I've gotten records back from purchased their drones via grants from the Department of Homeland Security or the Department of Justice, and a lot of those grants were given more or less with virtually no oversight as to what the drone was actually used for at the end. So there is a considerable government kind of public-private partnership through some of these grant programs. And it certainly, I mean, the profitability looks pretty good from where we're standing right now. The applications are numerous from both the public and private sector.
And just quickly, we've got an email or a post on our Facebook page from Chuck. How do you break down the manufacturing and production between the flying vehicle and its adaptation or application? For example, some are surveillance vehicles, some spread fertilizer, some deliver packages. Do we have drone manufacturers such as Lockheed, Northrop, and AeroVironment and modifiers that perfect the use? Who are these companies?
I mean, the drone is defined by the payload. So as Parker said earlier, the Predator drones that are being used along the border are very similar in terms of body to the ones that are being used in foreign theaters. But the key difference being that they're not armed. But a lot of manufacturers are specifically producing their models to have interchangeable payloads. So they have a spot, usually as George said, on the belly or the part underneath that would be facing the ground that determines what its function is. So that sensor can be really fine-tuned to whatever the aim of the drone is, whether it's surveillance in the visual spectrum. A lot of the drones that I've been looking at for law enforcement and public safety applications and also fire departments have thermal cameras or infrared. So the payloads are pretty wide and increasing daily.
Yeah, I don't think modifications posed a big problem for this industry. You know, whatever the client's interested in, and you know, we've seen this on the piloted aircraft side as well. Companies that manufactured a relatively small high altitude surveillance aircraft for special forces and DoD folks abroad have also been offering law enforcement side solutions to police departments in the United States. And we had a company tell us that the reason they did that is because the police departments were asking for it. Law enforcement customers were asking for a stateside version of high-altitude surveillance planes that were used in Iraq and Afghanistan.
And I think just generally, when you see the proliferation of these things, it's not necessarily because aviation technology has advanced. It's battery technology and it's sensor technology that keeps getting more powerful and smaller and cheaper. And so it's not so much about the body of these things, which might be a quadcopter or you know, some other design, But the fact that the same kinds of sensors that are being miniaturized to go in phones and in different devices can be used to conduct really high power surveillance without exacting too many demands on what sort of structure needs to carry it.
That is Parker Higgins, an activist at the Electronic Frontier Foundation. We're also joined by Sean Musgrave, projects editor of MuckRock, and George Schultz, an award-winning Homeland Security reporter for the Center for Investigative Reporting. And today we are talking about domestic drones in U.S. skies. This is expected to explode in the coming, well, really years. The FAA estimates that about 7,500 small drones will be in use within 5 years once the regulations are in place. And if you have any questions or concerns about this, if you work in this industry, if you work in agriculture or with animals, for example, and you're planning to use drones, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. What are your thoughts about the use of drones in the police departments? You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Meg in Salinas. Hi, Meg. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you. Good morning. Thanks for having this discussion. You know, I live in Salinas, and I listened to a caller earlier who called in and said, I don't know, he was describing the Wild West or something, or maybe the latest con movie he saw, but I live here, and I thought, gee, where's he getting this from? Because I don't see that there are, you know, police chasing down people and they're having shootouts at apartment buildings. I thought maybe he's watching too much Jason Bourne or something. I don't know. But I will say that Salinas has, you know, it gets a bad rap, and we have our share of problems like a lot of other cities, but I don't think that it's warranted to the point that we need to be giving up our rights. I mean, this is like an invasion of privacy. It's a big brother if you have to start thinking now that you've got drones that are surveilling, you know, cities, neighborhoods, and connected to police officers with Google Glass. Where does this stop? A lot of minorities, and there are a lot of minorities in Salinas, you know, they end up in the juvenile system. They end up in prisons. Big problem. And that's a big money profit industry. And if you don't have the money to fight, you know, to defend yourself, then you end up, like the governor said at one time, on this, you know, on this nonstop hamster wheel. And I just don't, I can see the use of drones for certain things, like they do use them in agriculture. I know that particularly they use them to go out and to check crops out, things like that. But to start thinking that we're going to be handing over this technology to police officers who themselves are not always above the law. I mean, south of here in King City, we just had 4 or 5 police officers all arrested for impounding vehicles from and selling them, making profits, and they were taking them all from illegal aliens. So this is a bigger issue, and I just it scares me when I think about, you know, the fact that you won't want to go outside your door, that everywhere you go there's a camera, that somebody, and how do you go about fighting this? They're going to say, well, we got it, we have it on camera, and now you have to, you know, fight against the system. Let's not give up rights.
Well,
that we have.
Yeah, you bring up some really great points. And Parker, how do citizens use their voices when it comes to regulations? I mean, are community meetings happening, or is this technology just being used, and then when something bad happens, then they go back and fix the problem?
Well, we've seen some of both, and I've certainly participated in community meetings, especially here around the Bay Area. In one case, in one high-profile case, police in Seattle had obtained a drone, and the city council didn't know about it until we uncovered records from the FAA. And that sort of thing leads to a backlash. And I think there's certainly a case to be made for narrow tactical uses and limited warranted uses of drones. And I would be encouraged to see law enforcement actually making that case to the public and really transparently laying out plans that say, this is why we think this is a good use of taxpayer money and won't infringe on civil liberties. But instead, what we see is really kind of underhanded tactics to get the grants from DHS to approve this without really studies or conducted into how they're going to be used. And over and over, we've seen at community meetings and city council meetings a line out the door from citizens who are concerned about this.
Well, and in order to be informed, Sean, we need reporters who can find this information. So how hard is it to get this info?
Incredibly is the easy way of saying it. We've been doing, over the past year, we've submitted more than 500 records requests to police departments all across the country. Our initial jumping-off point was the list that the Electronic Frontier Foundation obtained from the FAA after a pretty hard-fought lawsuit for their own information request, where we saw this list of agencies that had applied for authorization to fly drones. And based off of that, we started submitting requests to each of these agencies. And to their credit, there were a number of police departments. For instance, the Seattle Police Department, even though they did not disclose the fact that they had purchased this drone prior to 2012, when we asked them for records, they gave us a number of them. So, but that was the vast minority case. In other departments, we've gotten everything from wholesale rejections based on departments saying that to give up any documentation about drones would be to provide a tool to scoff laws and criminals for them to circumvent the law. We've gotten departments who have falsely claimed to us that they didn't have any documentation, only for us to find later that they ought to have given us records in the first place. And then we've also, even when we've gotten documents, we've seen a lot of the tactics that Parker was talking about in terms of police departments getting sole source contracts where they allege to their budgeting offices that these purchases need to be done outside of normal contracting because they should not be disclosed to the public. So it has been incredibly difficult for the public and for citizens to know just which departments are using this technology or exploring this technology, much less how they're doing so.
And George, we have about 20 seconds. Have you had similar problems in your reporting?
Oh yeah, it's been a real challenge, and it's really frustrating to me that in the 21st century there are fewer excuses for federal regulators to at least compile good data on the use of technologies like this, particularly if the technology is being purchased with federal grants. All the department issuing the grant has to do is say, okay, in order to receive this money or obtain this money, you have to report to us annually on the number of times you used your drone, type of drone, purpose of deploying it, so we have a better national picture of how this technology is being deployed. And that should be the same for an array of other technologies that police are using today.
Well, thank you for trying to get this information, and we will definitely continue following this issue. George Schultz is a reporter with the Center for Investigative Reporting. Parker Higgins is an activist with the Electronic Frontier Foundation. And Sean Musgrave is projects editor of MuckRock. Thank you all for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. What can we do to save the monarch butterflies? On the next Your Call, we'll talk about the plight of the monarch. Every year, they migrate thousands of miles from Canada to Mexico, but their numbers are rapidly dwindling. Habitat destruction from logging and the elimination of milkweed in the U.S. have brought this species to a tipping point. April 14th is a day of action for the monarchs, so how can we protect them, and why does it matter? Join the conversation on the next Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.